Chapter 26. Resentment in his tone. Oh, as to that, may I give myself some coffee? Milner, in his walk around the table to fill his cup, paused a moment to lay an affectionate hand on Draper's shoulder. Perhaps I know him better, in a sense. Outsiders often get a more accurate focus. Draper considered this. A near idea is that he acts on principles he has never thought of testing or defining. Milner looked up quickly, and for an instant their glances crossed. How do you mean? I mean, that he's an inconscient instrument of goodness, as it were? A sort of blindly beneficent force? The other smiled. That's not a bad definition. I know one thing about him, at any rate. He's awfully upset at your having chucked your Bible class. A shadow fell on young Spence's candid brow. I know. But what can I do about it? That's what I was thinking of when I tried to show him that goodness, in a certain sense, is purely subjective. That one can't do good against one's principles. Again his glance appealed to Milner. You understand me, don't you? Milner stirred his coffee in a silence not unclouded by perplexity. Theoretically, perhaps. It's a pretty question, certainly. But I also understand your father's feeling that it hasn't much to do with real life. Especially now that he's got to make a speech in connection with the founding of this missionary college. He may think that any hint of internecine strife will weaken his prestige. Mightn't you have waited a little longer? How could I, when I might have been expected to take a part in this performance? To talk and say things I didn't mean? That was exactly what made me decide not to wait. The door opened and Mr. Spence re-entered the room. As he did, so his son rose abruptly, as if to leave it. Where are you off to, Draper? The banker asked. I'm in rather a hurry, sir. Mr. Spence looked at his watch. Why, you can't be in more of a hurry than I am, and I've got 7 minutes and a half. He seated himself behind the coffee tray, lit a cigar, laid his watch on the table, and signed to Draper to resume his place. And no, Milner, don't you go. I want you both. He turned to the secretary. You know that Draper's given up his Bible class? I understand it's not from the pressure of engagements. Mr. Spence's narrow lips took an ironic curve under the straight-clipped stubble of his mustache. He's on principle, he tells me. He's principled against doing good. Draper lifted a protesting hand. It's not exactly that, Father, I know. You will tell me it's some scientific quibble that I don't understand. I've never had time to go in for intellectual hair splitting. I've found too many people down in the mire who needed a hand to pull them out. A busy man has to take his choice between helping his fellow men and theorizing about them. I've preferred to help. You might take that down for the investigator, Milner. And I thank God I've never stopped to ask what made me want to do good. I've just yielded to the impulse, that's all. Mr. Spence turned back to his son. Be better men than either of us have been satisfied with that creed, my son. Draper was silent, and Mr. Spence once more addressed himself to his secretary. M. Milner, you're a reader. I've caught you at it. And I know this boy talks to you. What have you got to say? Do you suppose a Bible class ever hurt anybody? Milner paused a moment, feeling all through his nervous system the fateful tremor of the balance. That's what I was just trying to tell him, sir. You were? That's good. Then I'll only say one thing more. You're doing what you've done at this particular moment hurts me more, Draper, than your teaching the gospel of Jesus could possibly have hurt those young men over in 10th Avenue. Mr. Spence arose and restored his watch to his pocket. I shall want you in 20 minutes, Milner. The door closed on him, and for a while the two young men sat silent behind their cigar fumes. Then Draper Spence broke out, with a catch in his throat, that's what I can't bear, Milner, what I simply can't bear. To hurt him, to hurt his faith in me. It's an awful responsibility, isn't it, to tamper with anybody's faith in anything? 3. The 20 minutes prolonged themselves to 40, the 40 to 50, and the 50 to an hour, and still Milner waited for Mr. Spence's summons. During the 2 years of his secretaryship, the young man had learned the significance of such postponements. Mr. Spence's days were organized like a railway timetable, and a delay of an hour implied a casualty as far-reaching as the breaking down of an express. Of the cause of the present derangement, Hugh Milner was ignorant, and the experience of the last months allowed him to fluctuate between conflicting conjectures. All were based on the indisputable fact that Mr. Spence was other that for some time past been bothered. And it was one of Milner's discoveries that an extremely parsimonious use of the emotions underlay Mr. Spence's expansive manner and fraternal phraseology, and that he did not throw away his feelings any more than, for all his philanthropy, he threw away his money. If he was bothered, then, it could be only because a careful survey of his situation had forced on him some unpleasant fact with which he was not immediately prepared to deal, and any unpreparedness on Mr. Spence's part was also a significant symptom. Obviously, Milner's original conception of his employer's character had suffered extensive modification, but no final outline had replaced the first conjectural image. The 2 years spent in Mr. Spence's service had produced too many contradictory impressions to be fitted into any definite pattern, and the chief lesson Milner had learned from them was that life was less of an exact science, and character a more incalculable element than he had been taught in the schools. In the light of this revised impression, his own footing seemed less secure than he had imagined, and the rungs of the ladder he was climbing more slippery than they had looked from below. He was not without the reassuring sense of having made himself, in certain small ways, necessary to Mr. Spence, and this conviction was confirmed by Draper's reiterated assurance of his father's appreciation. But Milner had begun to suspect that one might be necessary to Mr. Spence one day, and a superfluity, if not an obstacle, the next, and that it would take superhuman astuteness to foresee how and when the change would occur. Every fluctuation of the great man's mood was therefore anxiously noted by the young meteorologist in his service, and this observer's vigilance was now strained to the utmost by the little cloud, no bigger than a man's hand, adumbrated by the banker's unpunctuality. When Mr. Spence finally appeared, his aspect did not tend to dissipate the cloud. He wore what Milner had learned to call his backdoor face, a blank barred countenance, in which only an occasional twitch of the lids behind his glasses suggested that someone was on the watch. In this mood, Mr. Spence usually seemed unconscious of his secretary's presence, or aware of it only as an arm terminating in a pen. Milner, accustomed on such occasions to exist merely as a function, sat waiting for the click of the spring that should set him in action, but the pressure not being applied, he finally hazarded, "Are we to go on with the investigator, sir?" Mr. Spence, who had been pacing up and down between the desk and the fireplace, threw himself into his usual seat at Milner's elbow. "I don't understand this new notion of Draper's," he said abruptly. "Where's he got it from? No one ever learned your religion in my household." He turned his eyes on Milner, who had the sense of being scrutinized through a ground glass window which left him visible while it concealed his observer. The young man let his pen describe two or three vague patterns on the blank sheet before him. "Draper has ideas," he risked at last. Mr. Spence looked hard at him. "Tea, that's all right," he said. "I want my son to have everything. But what's the point of mixing up ideas and principles? I've seen fellows who did that, and they were generally trying to borrow $5 to get away from the sheriff. What's all this talk about goodness? Goodness isn't an idea. It's a fact. It's as solid as a business proposition. And it's Draper's duty, as the son of a wealthy man, and the prospective steward of a great fortune, to elevate the standards of other young men who haven't had his opportunities. The rich ought to preach contentment, and to set the example themselves. We have our cares, but we ought to conceal them. We ought to be cheerful, and accept things as they are, not go about sowing dissent and restlessness. What has Draper got to give these boys in his Bible class that's so much better than what he wants to take from them? That's the question I'd like to have answered. Mr. Spence, carried away by his own eloquence, had removed his pince-nez and was twirling it about his extended forefinger with the gesture habitual to him when he spoke in public. After a pause, he went on, with a drop to the level of private intercourse, I tell you this, because I know you have a good deal of influence with Draper. He has a high opinion of your brains. But you're a practical fellow, and you must see what I mean. Try to make Draper see it. Make him understand how it looks to have him drop his Bible class just at this particular time. It was his own choice to take up religious teaching among young men. He began with our office boys, and then the work spread and was blessed. I was almost alarmed, at one time, at the way it took hold of him. When the papers began to talk about him as a formative influence, I was afraid he'd lose his head and go into the church. Luckily, he tried university settlement first. But just as I thought he was settling down to that, he took to worrying about the higher criticism, and saying he couldn't go on teaching fairy tales as history. I can't see that any good ever came of criticizing what our parents believed, and it's a queer time for Draper to criticize my belief just as I'm backing it to the extent of 5 millions. Milner remained silent. And, as though his silence were an argument, Mr. Spence continued combatively, Draper's always talking about some distinction between religion and morality. I don't understand what he means. I got my morals out of the Bible, and I guess there's enough left in it for Draper. If religion won't make a man moral, I don't see why your religion should. And he talks about using his mind well, can't he use that in Wall Street? A man can get a good deal farther in life watching the market than picking holes in Genesis, and he can do more good too. There's a time for everything, and Draper seems to me to have mixed up weekdays with Sunday. Mr. Spencer placed his eyeglasses, and stretching his hand to the silver box at his elbow, extracted from it one of the long cigars sheathed in gold leaf which were reserved for his private consumption. The secretary hastened to tender him a match, and for a moment he puffed in silence. When he spoke again, it was in a different note. I've got about all the bother I can handle just now, without this nonsense of Draper's. That was one of the trustees of the college with me. It seems the flashlight has been trying to stir up a fuss. Mr. Spence paused, and turned his pince-nez on his secretary. Why, you haven't heard from them? He asked. From the flashlight? No. Milner's surprise was genuine. He detected a gleam of relief behind Mr. Spence's glasses. It may be just malicious talk. That's the worst of good works. They bring out all the meanness in human nature. And then there are always women mixed up in them, and there never was a woman yet who understood the difference between philanthropy and business. He drew again at his cigar, and then, with an unwonted movement, leaned forward and mechanically pushed the box toward Milner. Help yourself, he said. Milner, as mechanically, took one of the virginally cinctured cigars, and began to undo its wrappings. It was the first time he had ever been privileged to detach that golden girdle, and nothing could have given him a better measure of the importance of the situation, and of the degree to which he was apparently involved in it. Why, you remember that San Pablo rubber business? That's what they've been raking up, said Mr. Spence abruptly. Milner paused in the act of striking a match. Then, with an appreciable effort of the will, he completed the gesture, applied the flame to his cigar, and took a long inhalation. The cigar was certainly delicious. Mr. Spence, drawing a little closer, leaned forward and touched him on the arm. The touch caused Milner to turn his head, and for an instant the glance of the two men crossed at short range. Milner was conscious, First, of a nearer view than he had ever had of his employer's face, and of its vaguely suggesting a seamed sandstone head, the kind of thing that lies in a corner in the court of a museum, and in which only the round enameled eyes have resisted the wear of time. His next feeling was that he had now reached the moment to which the offer of the cigar had been a prelude. He had always known that, sooner or later, such a moment would come. All his life, in a sense, had been a preparation for it. But in entering Mr. Spence's service he had not foreseen that it would present itself in this form. He had seen himself consciously guiding that gentleman up to the moment, rather than being thrust into it by a stronger hand. And his first act of reflection was the resolve that, in the end, his hand should prove the stronger of the two. This was followed, almost immediately, by the idea that to be stronger than Mr. Spence's it would have to be very strong indeed. It was odd that he should feel this, since as far as verbal communication went it was Mr. Spence who was asking for his support. In a theoretical statement of the case the banker would have figured as being at Milner's mercy, but one of the queerest things about experience was the way it made light of theory. Milner felt now as though he were being crushed by some inexorable engine, of which he had been playing with the lever. He had always been intensely interested in observing his own reactions, and had regarded this faculty of self-detachment as of immense advantage in such a career as he had planned. He felt this still, even in the act of noting his own bewilderment, felt it the more in contrast to the odd unconsciousness of Mr. Spence's attitude, of the incredible candor of his self-abasement and self-abandonment. It was clear that Mr. Spence was not troubled by the repercussion of his actions in the consciousness of others, and this looked like a weakness unless it were, instead, a great strength. Through the hum of these swarming thoughts Mr. Spence's voice was going on. That's the only rag of proof they've got, and they got it by one of those nasty accidents that nobody can guard against. I don't care how conscientiously a man attends to business, he can't always protect himself against meddlesome people. I don't pretend to know how the letter came into their hands, but they've got it. And they mean to use it and they mean to say that he wrote it for me. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.